Hi, this is John Jenkins, senior editor of DealLawyers.com, and I'd like to welcome you to this edition of our Deal Lawyers Download podcast. My guests today are Tatiana Paterno, who is a partner at Bass, Berry & Sims, and Jessica Perlman, who is a partner at K&L Gates. Tatiana and Jessica co-chaired the 2021 Private Target Deal Point Study that was published by the ABA's M&A Committee. You may recall that we recently had Rita O'Neill, who spearheaded the completion of the ABA Public Targets Deal Point Study on the podcast, and we're delighted to welcome Jessica and Tatiana here today to share with us some insights on the private side of the world. So again, Jessica and Tatiana, welcome. Delighted to have you here today. Maybe we can start off by just having you, as we usually do with our podcast guests, tell us a little bit about yourselves and your backgrounds.
Thank you, John, so much. It's great to be here. This is Tatiana. I've been practicing M&A for over 15 years. Kind of crazy to say that. I focus on middle market private company M&A in the healthcare, manufacturing, business services, food and beverage, and entertainment industries. I became involved in the American Bar Association, the ABA, years ago when I was still an associate at Bass, Berry. One of my partners, Lee Walton, led the M&A committee of the business law section at the time, and she invited me to join. That led to meeting a lot of really remarkable attorneys through the Mergers and Acquisitions Committee, including Jessica. And I also got involved with the study and helped first as a member of the working group. Then I became an issue group leader. And then I got to work with Jessica directly for the last two studies.
Great. Jessica?
Yes, I'm pretty similar background, actually, maybe with a little, shall we say, extra seasoning. As I've been practicing M&A for, I think it's 22 years and change now. Like Tatiana, I focus on the middle market, on private target M&A across a number of different industries. In my case, with more deeper tech experience, I think, which makes sense given where I'm based. I'm out of the Seattle office of K&L Gates, my hometown. I work with buyers and sellers of all types, strategic, financial, closely held, you name it. And also, like Tatiana, I joined the M&A committee when I was an associate. I attended the meetings, and at one of the meetings, I raised my hand to volunteer with an early version of the study. And here I am today. That led for me to chair the study for, I think the last 12 years or so I've been chairing it. And I finally got smart and asked Tatiana to join me as a co-chair. And I also serve as a vice chair of the M&A committee.
Well, great. Well, let's talk about the study. Maybe a little bit about the methodology, how you go about preparing it. What was the universe of transactions, mergers, stock deals, asset deals, et cetera, that your committee reviewed?
So when you look at the study, you'll see that we include comparative data going back to 2004, which is for how long the study has been in existence. So we're getting close to 20 years. In the latest iteration of the study, which reflects transactions completed or signed in 2020, in the first quarter of 2021, that iteration came together over the course of last year. So we basically spent a lot of time on it throughout the year. We have a working group consisting of over 50 attorneys from 35 different law firms and companies. We break the work up by various issues that we're looking at. So, for example, we have an issue group focusing on representations and warranties, another issue group focusing on financial provisions, and another one focusing on sandbagging on reliance issue. So a total of 10 different issue groups. Each issue group has an IGL, an issue group leader, who leads a small team of 4 to 8 attorneys, depending on the complexity of the issue. Each agreement is reviewed at least twice by an initial reviewer who fills out a questionnaire reflecting how particular issues are addressed in the agreement, and a quality check reviewer, QC reviewer, who double checks the filled out questionnaire against the agreement. And Jessica and I also spot check the data where we see significant deviations from the prior study.
Yeah, and our IGLs also do some spot checking as well. So the end result for the 2022 study is that we had 123 agreements in our pool, and we knocked out deals where the target was in bankruptcy, where it was a reverse merger, if it was a divisional sale, and some other transactions that really aren't appropriate for inclusion that are very, for example, industry-specific deals like deals buying and selling banks or oil and gas. They tend to be very industry-specific in their terms. So we ended up with a purchase price range between $30 million and $750 million, sort of a broad look at the, quote, middle market. And purchase prices for most deals ended up below $200 million. Most deals are either equity purchases or mergers. I think under 20% were asset deals.
Okay. So obviously you had a lot of inputs, and let's talk a little bit about outputs. What kind of noteworthy trends did you find in the study? You know, reps and warranties, covenants, closing conditions, indemnity, differences between insured, uninsured deals, et cetera.
Well, I think one notable trend is in reps and warranties insurance itself. This is an area that has been really of a lot of interest for us M&A wonks over the last decade or so. For the purposes of our study, we measure the use of RWI in our deal pool really the only way we can. We look at whether the acquisition agreement references RWI somewhere in it, as a covenant, as a rep, as a closing condition. Now, of course, there could be deals that don't reference RWI but are still using RWI, but it's the best proxy we have, and when it is referenced, we at least know that that deal did use RWI. So in our last iteration of the study, it was big news that over half the deals in our pool referenced RWI. Well, that big news has turned into even bigger news in the latest iteration, because it's jumped up even higher to just under 2/3 of the study pool, or I think 65% to be specific, that referenced RWI. So a deal that otherwise meets our study parameters, public buyer, private target, between those price ranges, if that deal doesn't use RWI, that's really been a shrinking group over time. And I think that leads to some other noteworthy trends that you were asking about in indemnity. This is really evidence of a seller's market and the ability of sellers to dictate reps and warranty insurance-like terms, even in the absence of reps and warranties insurance. So more baskets are deductibles than they used to be. That's kind of matching up with what you would see in an RWI deal. And more of those baskets are kind of shrinking if you think of them as a percentage of deal size. So we actually correlate that data in our study, and you can see in the study that even in the deals that don't reference RWI, almost half of them, I think it was 47% if I remember correctly, have a threshold that's below 1% of the deal value. Threshold meaning you have to hit that number before the indemnity kicks in, of course. So similarly on the cap side of things, when there isn't a reference to RWI, we do see a mean and median for that cap as a percentage of deal value as being higher than the mean and median for deals that do reference RWI, but that mean and median is significantly lower than what it used to be for caps over time. And that's all laid out on page 106 of the study for those following along at home. I think another thing that I should mention here too is that we also always bring in new data points into our study. We have some really interesting data points that folks should take a look at about COVID and how it showed up for the first time, of course, in our study. And then we have to be thoughtful about how we record that data. It's obviously not relevant for deals before a certain point in time. Well, what's that point in time? We decided to use the day that the World Health Organization declared a global pandemic, that from that point on, we would look at whether a deal talked about COVID either as a covenant or in a rep, et cetera.
Another speaking about new data points, I think for the first time ever, right, we included data on termination fees. So I think it's on pages 23, 24 of the study, if you want to take a look, but we kind of break down the data there were 22% of the deals in the study pool that had termination fee provisions. So that data is in there as well, and pretty interesting.
great.
And Tatiana, I think we were also surprised and found noteworthy that earnouts went down, right?
Yes, that was one thing that was really kind of stood out for me. The earnouts actually went down during the period covered by the study. It went down from 27% to 20%. And in the early days of the pandemic, we all heard predictions that earnouts would be used more frequently to bridge the valuation gap. But it seems that those predictions really didn't materialize. We don't know if this happened because of the overall seller friendly market, or there was some other reason. I personally think it's because sellers had leverage to get buyers to pay all of the purchase price up front and avoid earnouts. And interestingly, in deals that did use earnouts, the parties were more likely to use revenue as a metric to determine an earnout payment, which is a seller favorable metric. While the use of earnings or EBITDA, which is a buyer friendly metric, substantially decreased. That was an interesting thing. And one other thing that was a little bit of a surprise to some of us is the data on cybersecurity rep. There was only a slight increase in the use of cybersecurity representation. So it increased from 30% to 33%. And, you know, with all the focus on cybersecurity issues, it seems like, you know, we're some of the agreements are a little bit behind on addressing the issues.
And one other data point that we introduced last time, I'm not sure if I'd categorize this as a surprise, but it may be a surprise to some people. And that was, we started measuring, two studies ago, we started measuring the Me Too representation. And that's on page 49 of the study. And we saw some form of the Me Too representation in 13% of that study pool. And that's gone up now to over a third, 37% of the current study pool. So, you know, the Me Too rep has not gone away, but what we have seen is an uptick in how often it's qualified by knowledge of the target company.
You know, if I can just interject one thing, I think it's going to be very interesting to see next year when presumably the SEC has the new cybersecurity rules in place, and the increasing importance of due diligence on the public company side when they're buying any target, if you do see a big ramp up in specific targeted cybersecurity reps than you saw in this year's survey.
Yeah,
I certainly expect a big ramp up in the due diligence side of things.
Yeah.
But I agree, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the rep itself.
Yeah.
It'd be hard to imagine that it wouldn't increase.
Now, I don't know if this is something that was within the scope of the survey itself, but you mentioned sort of the Me Too. Are any other kind of sort of ESG reps did you see emerging in this survey, or is that something that's really for further study?
You know, I think it's a little tricky to capture that. You don't tend to see a lot of reps around specific ESG initiatives. You'll see things, of course, there's always an environmental rep if there's real property involved, or a very short form one if there isn't real property involved. But we're not seeing, I think, reps that are more broadly, you know, what is your company philosophy towards stakeholders versus shareholder primacy, right? We're not seeing that kind of language. I do think it's affecting how folks are doing due diligence. And that, of course, we can't measure.
Right. Well, one thing I think you've been pointing to pages of the study and specific findings and where you can locate them. How about telling our listeners where they can get and how they can get a copy of the study itself?
The published study is available for download by the M&A committee members from the Market Trends Subcommittee's Deal Point Studies page. That is on the ABA website, so it's available to members. But, Jessica?
Yeah, but go ahead and just reach out to Tatiana or me. I am jessica.perlman@knlgates.com. Tatiana, your email address?
Yeah, tpaterno@bassberry.com, and we'll send you a copy.
Well, we'll be sure to plug both of those email addresses in the blog on this podcast, because I'm sure you'll be getting a number of people reaching out to you, and everybody very much appreciates that that kind offer. Well, this has been very interesting, and I appreciate both of you taking the time out of your busy schedules to participate in today's podcast. And hopefully, we'll be back in touch with you again next year, and you can tell us how things have changed again. But thanks very much for your time, and thanks to everyone here for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, John.